Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And we're getting ready to all pile into, I guess Brad will be driving, getting ready to
pile into
Brad's car and head out to southern Indiana on a little summer road trip. But first, we've got some business to take care of, right? We're going to visit the Mannings at Streamcliff Herb Farm, which is a really fabulous place. Agritourism, I guess, is the best sort of description in terms of it's a destination where there's gardens that you can tour, also nursery plants that you can purchase. They've got a tea room, you know, for lunch. They do seminars and lectures and educational stuff, and it's historic and it's just lovely.
Yeah, it's been there a long time.
Beautiful.
They do a great job with it. They send out a flyer every spring of the events. It's like 19 pages, single spaced. I mean, they really are busy and do a great job with it. It's a fun place to visit. It's just far enough out of Louisville. You think you're going somewhere, but it's not. It's less than an hour easily.
Yeah.
It's a good place to visit. It's kind of like Hidden Hill with food and on steroids.
Yeah, and like, you know, spend the whole day there, which is pretty cool.
You can do that,
So we're going to find out the details of historic Streamcliff Herb Farm, fifth generation of the family participating in all the different things they do.
Almost to North Vernon.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then we're also in the Scottsburg area, right? Henryville, Scottsburg.
Yeah.
We're going to visit Memory View Nursery, Paul and Marilyn Rogers.
Yeah, they've kind of quietly developed a really nice ornamental grass nursery up there. They do wholesale and retail both.
Mm-hmm.
They've got 40 different kinds of grasses. They're really, really nice people. You see them, you go to different seminars and fairs, and they're sitting there, and very pleasant. And, you know, it's kind of like the rest of us. It's a hobby run amok, I think, a little bit. But they have a lot of really neat stuff. And, again, it's less than probably a half hour, 45 minutes from Louisville. So, you know, make a day of it and go to Streamcliff and stop by and get some grass and some food and have a good time.
Yeah. So we're going to do it for you first.
Yeah.
To see how,
somebody
how
has
easily
to do
successful you can have
we're
like, a
pleasant
day. We're
going to suffer on this one.
Yeah. All right. So that's coming up today on Homegrown. Please stick around. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I might have talked about this before, but it's finally coming together. I got the perennial border finally so stuffed with things that weeds aren't an issue. And this time of year is when I really need weeds not to be an issue.
No kidding. But, when you know, it's 90 degrees
out. Yeah,
and
but you know, there's all sorts. I got beautyberries and grasses and boltonia, which is kind of a near weed itself.
I love boltonia.
I do too, though, but it really is aggressive. Hibiscus, rue, roses, all filling in nicely, and there's not a weed to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
They're just all shoved in there.
Yeah.
And just to remind people that, you know, keep doing that, and after 3 or 4 years, it's just such a joy to go out there and see these plants. Now, you got to stake them up once in a while. And of course, deadhead, that's never ending. But the weeds are gone.
The weeds are gone.
How about the Wishes State? What's up?
I have to show you. I don't know what happened.
Uh-oh.
I got a little bag here. Okay.
Is it a dead something?
No.
You've been doing dead pretty lately out there. Quite a bit lately out there.
Can't you smell it a little bit?
I think it's your perfume.
I don't wear perfume.
Eau de Wishy.
But yeah, I probably do smell a little bit like this because we just ate a whole bunch of it for dinner last night.
Okay, I didn't.
I harvested the garlic.
Oh.
And
I'm going to leave the room while you finish
but
this
Bob,
one.
Bob, look at this. Okay, this is what my garlic usually looks like.
Okay,
right?
She's holding up, looks like a pencil-sized sticky thing with maybe a slightly smaller than the golf ball size.
Oh, you know, the garlics.
Attached to it.
So that's my average.
That's your average garlic.
And I replant the same, I don't even know what kind of garlic it is, but it's some that we've had around forever. So I replant every year, right? Just save from the garlic that I'm not eating.
Next up will be a bigger garlic, I'm thinking.
So,
oh my gosh.
So that's what most of it looks like this year.
We're approaching billiard ball.
Check this
one
out.
Holy cow.
Look at that.
You've got the billiard ball
it
size.
It looks like elephant garlic.
Yeah.
Like the size of elephant garlic. I do not know, other than maybe just the rain came at the right time or something.
It's the same stuff as before.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
It's huge.
It's a billiard ball on a stick.
It's really, and it's, I'm just
and it
delighted.
Smells like dirty garlic, which is what it's supposed to.
Because
if I take a bite of it, I'll probably fall over.
So I've told my mom and my sister, do not buy any garlic. We're going to have plenty to get us through the year this year.
I'm going
to
work my way through the outer layers here. And see
I'll let you take those home, too.
Oh.
Because Janet cooks with garlic, doesn't she?
You betcha.
Yeah, so you can take the big one home, and then Brad can take the other
one
home.
Oh, my gosh.
Pretty cool, though, huh?
I'm proud of you.
Yeah, I'm amazed. So, okay, one other thing I want to mention about the whole garlic thing. When I was at the Bullitt County Fair, great group of master gardeners out there in Extension, and somebody had a question about elephant garlic. And she was wondering, every year it never cloves up. She harvests it and it's kind of like an onion still. And I had no idea. You know, I'm like, I don't know. So I looked into it. And as it turns out, elephant garlic is actually a little bit more closely related to a leek than actual garlic.
Okay.
And it doesn't clove up until the second year, Bob.
I didn't know
that. If you try to grow elephant garlic, you've got to leave it in the ground for 2 years.
Does it have tusks after the second year?
It could.
Or a trunk?
It could.
Is it gray?
It's just really big, Bob.
Okay.
Kind of like my garlic.
It is.
It's crazy, you all.
I'm so proud of you.
I'm just delighted. So, all right. So, on to the calendar events. Speaking of garlic and food, tomatoes are definitely coming in for people, and I think there's some tomato festivities going around.
On Saturday, August 7th, the St. Matthew's Farmers Market will feature an heirloom tomato day. It's at the Beargrass Christian Church in Shelbyville Road. 30 varieties of heirloom tomatoes donated by the farmers will be displayed for free tasting. Visitors can vote for their favorites. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Be from 8 a.m. until noon.
I think the Bullitt County people are going to be doing something like that, too.
August 7th.
Probably lots of that in the month of August.
Our heirlooms have been fabulous.
Yeah.
We had one called Black Semen, I think it is, which is really a dark skin and, and a dark tomato.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost softball size.
Yeah, and they're so good, aren't they?
I want to show your garlic to them and see what they can do.
See, that is like the perfect marriage of food, right? Garlic and tomatoes.
Oh, man.
Oh, man, no kidding. All right, you ready to hit the road, Bob?
Yep, we're going to go back home again.
All right.
In Indiana.
All right.
And I won't sing for another 3 years, I promise.
Okay, good. All right, Bob, we've made it, headed up the expressway into Indiana, and we are now here in Vienna. Is that how you say it?
Close enough.
You're from Indiana?
Close enough.
All right, not Vienna, but Vienna.
Vienna. Yeah. Like Versailles.
That's right.
Nothing up on Kentucky. Yeah, this is really, it's going to be a great show for family farms. We're going to start out here with a couple named Paul and Marilyn Rogers. We'll mostly talk to Paul, but they live on a home place for three generations, and we'll go down the road later to Streamcliff, and that's four generations, which is really...
Or five generations, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's really a nice way to deal with farming and gardening and just be...
Because so often we talk about losing the family farm, and there's ways, I guess, these are the different creative ways in which you can also continue to make it work by embarking on new endeavors. And ornamental grasses is sort of what you've found to be your niche after all these years.
Yeah, we're perched in this farmhouse overlooking a lot of grasses outside. It's really a nice view. We're in the kitchen of Paul and Marilyn Rogers here in Vienna, and we're about to talk to Paul. He and Marilyn opened the Memory View Greenhouse about 25 miles north of Louisville near Scottsburg in 1993. The nursery primarily features 40 kinds of ornamental and native grasses, but features a lot of other plants too. And today, Paul is going to talk about these grasses and what got Marilyn and him into the business. So, Paul, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here, and I'd like to share what little I know about the grasses and the reason I like working with them. And you're right about the 40 different grasses. I counted up this morning at breakfast. There's 48 different grasses, 25 species, and I keep adding a few more. Matter of fact, we've got five more varieties just last week.
Well, let's back up just a little bit and kind of explain to our listeners how you got on this farm and what the history of it is and why it's called Memory View, which is really a nice name.
Well, I grew up on the farm. I was actually born in the old farmhouse on the other side of the greenhouse from where we are right now, and was here until I left for Purdue. And while at Purdue, I met my wife, Marilyn, and we did not live back here for 40 years. And
So what did you get yourself into after Purdue?
I spent 35 years in the agriculture chemical business.
Okay.
Partly sales, and the last 15 years mostly in research side.
Okay. And Memory View is such a nice, sweet name, really. Explain exactly why it's called Memory View here.
Well, God has created a great view for us. We overlook the knobs that I teasingly call the SIRs, the Southern Indiana Rockies.
Uh-huh. All right.
And we designed our house so that we can see the great view from all directions. I can look out my bedroom window and see our pond or small lake. I can look out to the west and see the fields of corn and soybeans and the hay field. And that's where we came up with Memory View Farms and then later Memory View Greenhouse.
So how did you get into the ornamental grass thing then?
Well, that's the year that we built the house.
Yeah.
A.J. Powell, Dr. Powell at U of K.
My favorite agronomist.
Yes. I was calling on him for business reasons.
Sure.
And was asking him about landscaping, and he suggested ornamental grasses. And asked me to pick out some and said that they were cleaning out their grass gardens at Spindlewick Farms and would send me some. So he sent me 12. So I've grown from the 12 to 48 right now.
But that's still a pretty big leap from going into nursery business to what you were doing. Was there something earlier in your life that prompted this, or were you guys sitting around one night and saying, hey, let's start a nursery, or what?
Well,
your wife told you to do it.
Yeah. That's part of it. Actually, I worked in the greenhouse when I was at Purdue, and I'd always thought I'd like to have a greenhouse or a garden center, but never really had the opportunity. And after we moved here and got our house built, there was a 43-acre farm became available next door, and there was a small greenhouse on it, and we were able to talk the finance company into loaning us some money to buy that farm, and the small greenhouse was there. The fellow that we're buying from wanted to continue to operate it, and Marilyn got interested in the greenhouse, and our partner convinced her that we should build a bigger greenhouse, so we built a 30 by 40 greenhouse, and things went pretty well. And the following year, we built one a little bigger, and things went pretty well. And the third year, we built another one.
And things went?
Pretty good.
Well, let's talk about these grasses. You start with those 12. Was it immediate affinity, or did you have to kind of learn to like grasses before you developed more and more of the business in that direction?
Kind of had to learn to like the grasses. The greenhouse business... at that time, we didn't think the grasses fit very well. We added two or three, and I just enjoyed fooling with them there on what I call the grass garden. Mm-hmm. And then I found out there were more and more people wanting them, and I think the trends to use more and more ornamental grasses as part of the future of the landscape business. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the knockout roses. They're very easy to care for, and... I see that as a growing area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and environmentally friendly, too, really, if you think about it, because they don't require, once they're established, they don't require a lot of watering. They don't require pesticides and stuff because there's not a lot of pest pressure. So it fits into this more sort of green revolution, too.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't use any fertilizer on my grass garden. I've never used any insecticides. Mm-hmm. I do use herbicide once in a while, a little Roundup to clean up. But that is, I think they're very good for the green movement.
Now, we just took a little walk through your grass area, so let's talk about specific needs and specific sites. Say I got a neighbor next door that I sort of like, but I want my privacy too. What grasses would you recommend for some tall barrier between you and the neighbor that would still be attractive and you can live with it yourself?
Well, it kind of depends on how tall you want. I have the... giant reed, which will get up to about 18 feet tall.
And is that the Arundo grass?
The Arundo grass, okay. Yes. And it's looks like a huge corn stalk. That may be a little taller than a lot of people want. I think probably the next step would be the northern pampas grass, Ravina. That's about 12 feet. Maybe not as good for privacy as one of the Miscanthus, Miscanthus giganthus. Mine's about 10 feet tall. And you can just build a solid wall with it. And I've had people do that and have come back a year or two later and tell me how much they appreciate the privacy they have from that type of grass.
I've even seen some mazes built of stuff like that where you kind of curly-cue and circle around and there's a bench in the middle of it. Really kind of fun to do that.
That's right. And I like alternating some of the grasses. I like some of the variegated miscanthus. Cabaret is one of my favorites. And I like the color. Most of the taller grasses do not have a lot of color other than the variegation. There's some smaller grasses that are in the 3 to 4 to 5 feet tall that you're picking up some purples and some rust colors. Mm-hmm. I think those are going to be seen more and more. Another one that's I like to think of as double color, and that's the Carl Forrester with your nice bright tan plumes and then a dark green foliage.
And the Carl Forrester, it seems to tolerate a little more shade than some of the other grasses.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then another one in that same family, the Overdam, which is a variegated, and I like it very much also.
Okay. What about wet areas, say a swampy side or a bog side, where you want something that's attractive and also a place where you can hide birds and frogs and that kind of stuff?
There are some rushes that fit into that area. There's a number called an umbrella palm, but it is not hardy in this area. And just yesterday, in my spare time, I continue to look at books. If I can't learn something new every day, it's been a bad day. But I see that there is it's called an umbrella palm, but I believe it's another rush, but it is zone 5 hardy. Okay. And that would be great to go into that area.
How big would that get, this umbrella palm? It's a P-A-L-M, like a palm tree, I take it.
Right. They're 5 feet, 6 feet. I've got some that are not hardy. Last year they were in the greenhouse about all year, and they got up to 7 feet.
Any coconuts?
No coconuts.
So, Paul, I think my favorite ornamental grass is the switchgrass, Panicum. Mm-hmm. What do you have in your offerings for the switchgrasses?
And the switchgrasses, I have heavy metal, Shenandoah, which has the rust coloring on it. The heavy metal is a nice blue-gray color. Mm-hmm. The new one that I've added to the list this year is ruby red. And it's got a lot more color than Shenandoah, maybe a little bigger than Shenandoah, not quite as upright. Okay. I like all of those. Mm-hmm.
Then there's some grasses that in the same family sort of have a nice, really nice fall color, kind of like Carly Rose and those kind of grasses that get better every day into the fall.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Carly Rose is beautiful year-round, with the exception of the month of April, after it's either been burned or cut.
Right.
Mine started putting out the purple-pink plumes in late May this year. And you're right, they'll stay pretty right on into the fall, just a little deeper color.
And then there's sort of almost invasive grasses like ribbon grass that really have a place in the landscape if you need something to cover a lot and you're not too close to the house, right?
That's true. The ribbon grass will do a good job there. The lime grass is another one. Has a beautiful seed head on it. Looks like a wheat head, but it's about 4 or 5 times the size of a wheat head. And if you've got a place that is eroding away from that you don't want to mow, that would be a beautiful grass. The name lime grass fits it very well. It's a lime green to a gray green color, and very hardy.
Reseeds itself?
It does not reseed itself,
but it clumps up well.
It's some runners.
Okay.
If you're going to plant it in a planting and don't want it to spread, either find a concrete pot or a very heavy plastic container. Mm-hmm.
So, Paul, let me ask you this, because you'd said you love the plant every month of the year except in April when you have to cut it down or burn it. So is there an advantage to burning your ornamental grasses from time to time instead of just cutting them back?
Yes, there is. I like burning them. Mine are located where I don't have to worry about them. And,
right. It's not for everyone, huh?
When you burn, it's easy, and you get rid of all the trash down in the bottom. Uh-huh. If you cut them, most of the time we get them cut down and clean up the big parts, we still leave trash down in the center of the clump. When you burn it, get rid of that. Yeah. We don't have many diseases in the grasses, but if you're going to have, that would be an ideal place for disease or insects to harbor.
Okay.
In the center
of
the
center there. Yeah.
Yes.
So what about division? Because that's, I think, maybe the one criticism that people have, that they're so robust that they're extremely difficult to divide, you know, later on in life. But like, do they even need to be divided at all?
Most of the time they don't. The most of the grasses that I started with, those 12, the ones that have left have not been divided other than starts that I've taken out to
propagation
sell.
Purposes, yes. Yeah.
And I'm so lazy at times I don't even dig them up to get my own starts. Mm-hmm. I'll buy plugs from a good producer, and I know that I've got the exact variety that I want. Where if you're digging, you may not have.
Mm-hmm. So it's not necessary. Right?
No, it's not necessary to divide.
That's good, because it sure is tough. You need a, you need a chainsaw to cut them down and to dig and divide them sometimes.
If you're wanting to divide them up or to clean them up, that's fine. And that's just a good sharp spade will do that for you.
You know, native grasses and native plants in general are hot these days. I know you got some little blue stem out there. Anything else you might have that would qualify as native?
Not potted right now, but I do have big blue stem Indian grass. We've got a set-aside field of about 15 acres, and it's...
So you have your own prairie planted out then with these warm season grasses? Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I renovate a third of that every year and come back in with Lespedeza and birdsfoot trefoil for the birds. Uh-huh. And the forbs were planted at the same time as the grasses, and wildlife like it. The only thing that our son is an avid deer hunter. Mm-hmm. It's a good place for the deer to hide and get lost.
That's true. So your native warm season grass, prairie, and forbs, that's really just for your own enjoyment? Or are you harvesting seeds or anything from that? Or is it just good, you know, management practices for the property?
It's a set-aside program that I participate in.
Okay.
And it's also for wildlife production.
Similar to the program in Kentucky, that's, I think...
it's a federal program.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right.
And some years I think it's a good program. Other years when we have good crops, I wish I'd had a crop.
Well, Paul, thanks a lot. We enjoyed talking to you, and just a great place and a great place to come home to.
Thank you.
We're going to have to go outside now and pick out my small ornamental grasses for my new planting, okay?
Okay.
All right.
It's a deal. Paul and Marilyn Rogers opened the Memory View Greenhouse near Vienna, Indiana in 1996. The nursery primarily features 40 kinds of ornamental and native grasses. For more information on the nursery, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Next stop, Comiskey, Indiana and Streamcliff Herb Farm. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill. We are sitting in the winery at Streamcliff Farm in one of the most elegant and nostalgic and really well-done places I think I've ever been, certainly in Indiana.
I'd have to say so. Like the old farmhouse dating back from the 1800s, all the outbuildings, just everything. And the gardens are fabulous. I'm so surprised that I've never been here before. So I'm delighted to finally have made it. We're sitting here with Betty. Betty and her husband Gerald Manning own and operate historic Streamcliff Herb Farm. It is a family affair by all accounts. Their children are the fifth generation to be involved at the farm. Their daughter Elizabeth manages the tea room. Their son Greg oversees the greenhouses and the nursery production. Streamcliff also offers a complete experience, I think, in terms of visiting gardens, lunch options, plants for sale, now a winery, all kinds of seminars. It's just really a fabulous place, Betty, and thanks for having us out.
Thank you. It's nice to have you come visit.
So we are in Comiskey, Indiana. Is there any relation to the ballpark?
Actually, the family originally had connections to the Comiskey ballpark in Chicago.
So the city.
Patrick Comiskey was the founder, and he was superintendent of the railroad when it went through about 1870, so it was named after him.
Okay. So, fifth generation of your family being here. Mm-hmm. Take us back to who came first and the old farmhouse and all of that. What's the history of the place in terms, and the value of it in terms of your family history?
Well, actually, the history of the farm starts in about the 1820s. James Harmon came here from Maine, and he lived in a hollow tree with pigs underneath it to keep him warm.
That's great.
And he came to Indiana to collect his father's land grant. His father had served in the Revolutionary War under Benedict Arnold, actually. Mm-hmm. And so when the war was over, General Washington didn't have money to pay his troops, and so he gave them land on West, and West at that time was Indiana. So James Harmon came. His father was never able to come. He lived here alone. He was the occupant when it was raided during the Civil War by Morgan's Raiders. He built the big barn first, and then he baked all the bricks for the house.
Wow.
When he died, being a bachelor and no heirs, he left the property to the Methodist Church. It was actually for Asbury College, which was DePaul.
Okay.
He wanted it called the Harmon Chair for Professorship of Biblical Literacy.
Uh-huh.
And so then the Methodist Church held the farm for a few years and then sold it to my grandmother's family. So it's come down through the family since shortly after the Civil War.
Wow, what a great story, huh? Mm-hmm. For you all, for you and Gerald, when did you take over the farm? And, you know, how did it evolve into what we see today? I mean, I think it's fair to consider it an agritourism sort of place, you know, that full experience. But it doesn't just happen like that overnight. So what was going on with you all?
Actually, we were in agritourism before it actually had a term.
Exactly.
But both of us had careers, and I always loved nature, and I was a farm girl. Mm-hmm. And my grandparents and great-grandparents, of course, had lived here. And I started getting really interested in some of the early traditional crafts, and I started making old corn chuck dolls. And that was actually before dried flowers were even very popular. And so then I grew a lot of dried flowers, and then I grew more herbs to go with that. And then I started using a lot more herbs in cooking, and I started teaching classes.
And the obsession
people
grows.
Were so interested in using herbs in cooking. And that was a time when not many people actually used very many herbs. This would have been the early 70s.
Okay.
And so as we grew more herbs, and then we ended up more plants, and we sold our crafts, and both of us had jobs on the side. And then we just decided to start with the classes, and people liked that food so well. And then I decided eventually that we would put in the tea room and have herbal food. That was a time, of course, that I couldn't hire anybody around to do that. Now we have good people that do that. And so one thing led to the other, and then eventually as we sold more plants and had the tea room, and we use edible flowers and herbs a lot still today. And then a few years ago, about 4 years ago, we opened our winery. We thought about that, and it takes several years to get the process underway. And so we opened it 4 years ago. And that's been a real good thing for us. We've enjoyed making our own wine and selling the wine. And I think it complements our history interest and, art and history and gardening. It all goes hand in hand, and adding the component of good wine really complements that. And so that's been just a real nice addition that we have added to the business.
Betty, I want to emphasize to our listeners, these are original buildings here. This isn't something that you mm-hmm. brought at Lowe's and hauled in here. We're sitting before a stone fireplace, and the old house is still here. So which building did you use first, and how did you decide what to do and to turn this thing into what you got now?
Well, it's been a labor of love, and most of the labor actually has been my husband's. It was sort of my dream and his execution. But one of the first buildings that we started using was what we call our country store, and actually had been my grandmother's chicken house. And then we did the building we call the cabin, and that actually was my grandfather's blacksmith shop. And we would use our home at the time for classes also. And then one by one, we worked on other buildings. We had a summer kitchen, so we worked on that one. And then we needed a classroom, and we have what we call our keeping room. And it actually was a building that the railroad built as a boarding house when the railroad went through about 1870. And so we have quilt shows and craft shows and classes and things and that. And then the tea room actually at one time had, was a greenhouse, and we're sitting in the winery. And the winery actually had been Gerald's blacksmith shop. He had all of my grandfather's blacksmithing equipment, and he used to do ornamental blacksmithing. And so when we decided to put the winery in, the ornamental blacksmithing stopped and winemaking began. And so it's in that same building.
Yeah. And you've got rooms outside, too. We took a brief tour around in different religious significance or just different places. There's benches, there's shade, there's picket fences everywhere with roses growing through them. How'd that evolve?
Well, you know, gardening to me and living close to nature, it's a fairly spiritual experience for me. And I felt like that that should be an extension of that care and concern that we have for the environment and for nature. And my grandmother was a quilter and a gardener, and so she lived here for more than 50 years. So the first garden that we put in was a grandmother's fan quilt design, and then we put in a Dresden plate quilt design, and then we put a log cabin quilt design, and then we put a crucifix, which has a heart in a square, which is a quilt design of that one. And then we have a little four square one that we have our herbs in. And so it's just evolved primarily because my grandmother lived here so many years, and we did the gardens as really a tribute to her.
That's what's so, I guess, so nice about this place, and maybe why it's so successful, is that there's real family connection and meaning behind everything, you know, that's taking place. How are your kids involved in all of this as well?
Well, you know, without our children, we could not be involved in this, but we also have some wonderful friends and family that help, so it's certainly not just the two of us that do everything. We have six grandchildren. They're fairly small yet, but in time, I hope they can come along and help. But Elizabeth, she graduated from Hanover College and taught school for a few years, and then she decided to run the tea room, and so she does a beautiful job with her staff in running the tea room. And then Greg studied horticulture, and he worked in horticulture elsewhere, and then he decided to come home and start working in the horticultural aspects of that. And so both of our children are involved. I always laugh and say it's a good thing we get along pretty well, because we're with everybody every day.
Right.
But we get along very well, and it's they're quite an asset and blessing to us.
Yeah. So the last completed endeavor was the winery. Mm-hmm. Are there other things that you guys are thinking about that, you know, might come together and really make it complete?
Well, you know, there's probably, I mean, we've talked
reasonably
about this. The vineyard is going to be the next big project, and so that's something that all of us will have to make a mutual decision about. It's when, not if, but eventually that will come.
So for
but we're
now,
we're really growing really good. We're really making very good wine. Mm-hmm. You know, with the grapes that we're able to obtain.
So for now, you're not growing your own grapes. You're purchasing them from other places.
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But down the road, we will grow. We will have a vineyard. But that's down the road as soon as we can do that.
So if I came for a meal here in, say, April and then July and then October, what would I find different each time?
Well, we feel like that the tea room actually is the crown jewel here. It's extremely popular. All the food is handmade. We probably specialize in desserts, and I bet about 80% of the people that come will have desserts, because it's very hard to go places and find real homemade desserts, especially. And but they make everything here, and it's all made out of the freshest of ingredients.
And, so do you try to access local?
Yes, we do,
as much as you can.
As much as possible. And so we feel like that the tea room is very special, and we specialize a lot in our dill and rosemary and basils, and so our herbs are so vitally a part of the food that we serve.
I hate to use the word meat at this point in the conversation, but do you raise chickens or beef or things like that, or is it pretty much veggies and organic stuff?
Well, we have a very small flock of chickens that has been recently added again. We've had them before, and we have some goats, and we have donkeys, and we have horses, and so the family has just always had animals in our life, so that's a part
of
it.
But not necessarily
for
dinner.
No, we don't eat our animals, but we've always had animals in our life.
Indiana, and like the wine tour, I mean, they're pretty organized with all of this stuff and promoting it and the notion of agritourism. Where do you stand? I mean, clearly it's important because you're involved in it, but how important is agritourism on that economic level, but also on that cultural level and preservation and conservation level?
We're on the Indiana Wine Trail, and there are six wineries, three in Madison and one at Vivi and one at Batesville. They're also on that Indiana Wine Trail. And it's very interesting, the people that do the wine trail. You meet the nicest folks that come. And I think that agritourism has so many benefits in many ways. It's a very, to me, clean industry. Mm-hmm. People come, they stay in bed and breakfast, they eat in various places, they go to gift shops, they support many, many endeavors. And so agritourism is really something that's vitally important. And I think until the last few years, maybe that wasn't deemed to be as important as what it actually is to a local economy.
Mm-hmm. Now, would the Huber Winery be on a separate wine tours, the state divided up into different areas of wine tours?
Yes, there are three wine trails. Huber's, I think they're on the Upland Trail, and then there's an Indy Wine Trail, but we're on the Indiana Wine Trail, which is primarily the southeast, not so far from the Ohio River. We think our wine trail is really scenic and pretty, so I hope that others agree with that.
So, Betty, you had commented to us before that you don't do much advertising, yet the parking lot's packed. Because you all are open Wednesday through Sunday. Is word of mouth, you've been around long enough, people know the value. What do you attribute to the popularity?
I think it's because we've been in business so long, and I think it's mostly word of mouth.
And people enjoy it so much.
We have a huge mailing list that we send out a brochure early in the year, but we really don't need to advertise very much because people just kind of show up. I always like to say, people will ask me so often, well, how do people find you way out here in the middle of nowhere? And my answer always is, oh, do you think this is the middle of nowhere? Of course they say, oh, yes, it's the middle of nowhere. And I always tell them, you know, I'm surprised that you would say that. It actually seems like the center of the universe to me. I'm surprised that you think it's the middle of nowhere, but really it is kind of in the middle of nowhere, I know.
It's off the beaten track. How about that?
Yes.
That's a little bit different. So one of the things, when you send out this newsletter in the spring, there's a considerable list of seminars and activities that you all offer. So can you give us a sampling? I mean, we're going into the month of August. Can you give us a sampling of what will be offered?
Well, early on in the garden season, we do a lot of gardening classes and a lot of make and take projects. We have a lot of bus tours that come through and people make perhaps hanging baskets or herb pots, different things that they'd like to take home. And then as the summer evolves, we tend to get into more cooking classes and using herbs and, you know, when the basils and all the things become so abundant, we do a lot more cooking classes. Cooking classes are incredibly popular, and we've taught cooking classes for years. And actually, I'm working on a cookbook. Then, you know, as the cooking classes, we continue those to clear up through the Christmas season. But we also then start adding art classes, painting gourds, palette painting. I paint primitive, like the Grandma Moses style. Okay. So we do a lot of different painting classes. And then toward holiday time, we add holiday classes, classes we've done for years.
Like
and
they remain
very popular.
So do you bring in other people to conduct the classes, or are you mostly doing it yourself?
Well, we used to do a lot of outside speakers, and we find that our classes fill so well when we're doing them that we just do our own primarily anymore, because it seems like the demand is more for that than bringing in outside folks. But we're always open to that. If someone, you know, wants to come and give a talk, we're always open to that.
So if you had to draw a circle of your tourist base, would it be like Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Louisville, and Los Angeles? Or how big would it be here?
Well, it's wide. It isn't local. Primarily, it's Louisville, Indianapolis, Cincinnati. We have a lot of folks from up in Ohio on the wine trail especially. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have people from many, many states that come. We've been in several national magazines and are going to be in another one next summer, a major article. And so I think that the magazines have really brought people from such a distance.
Yeah, great. Tours. If people are interested in bringing out a bus tour, very easy, just contact you all. There's a website and make arrangements, because you'll do specific things for specific groups, yes?
Oh, yes. We do a lot of tours. We do ask that a group needs to be 15 or more if we're going to do a craft project or a project, but we just do an awful lot of tours. Our people just come as a group and have lunch, or you can come individually to have lunch also. And we have candlelight dinners usually about once a month of an evening, and that is by reservation, but otherwise we don't take reservations unless a group has more than eight, and then we take reservations. Otherwise, we just don't take reservations. We used to, and it really slowed us down, and people had to wait so long, so we just don't do that anymore.
So the candlelight dinners, are they usually on a Saturday?
They're on Saturdays. Okay. And the website streamcliffarm.com, and so you can check about that.
So the name of the farm?
Is Streamcliff Farm.
And it and was I actually inspired named by? It.
All right. I named it because we're on top of an 80-foot cliff, and there's a beautiful stream called Graham Creek that's just below. And I named that many years ago, and it's just kind of stuck over all the years.
And even now, do you get up in the morning, look out the window and say, oh, my God, I got to do it again, or can you not wait to get out here?
You know, I look at our life as being blessed. It's a lot of hard work, but, you know, I grew up on a farm, and I know that that's part of what it takes to keep something successful. And, you know, we are so blessed to have our family and friends and to have the grandchildren in our lives. And, you know, it's beautiful when you get up in the morning, look over toward the creek, and it's just breathtaking sometimes. So
it's truly a beautiful place.
I feel that we're very fortunate to be here.
Yeah, beautiful place.
Well, you're right, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for sharing it with so many people. Betty and Gerald Manning own historic Streamcliff Herb Farm in Comiskey, Indiana, where you will find plenty to occupy the day. It's definitely worth a visit. Enjoy the gardens, have some lunch, buy some plants, and stay for an educational seminar as you wish. Streamcliff is open Wednesday through Saturday during the season. You can, of course, visit our website at wfpl.org for more detail.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill, we have a couple questions today.
We do indeed.
You want to start, Miss Wishy?
Sure. This one's from Judy. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you might know what is causing all the small branches with green leaves and acorns attached to come off our oak tree. I've heard that it is some kind of beetle eating through the wood. Is that right? And if so, would you know the name of the insect and if there's anything to do about it? There are also a lot of galls on the trees, and they, too, are falling to the ground. Thank you for your help, Judy.
Yeah, it does sound like a beetle, and in fact, you've had the same problem at your place, so you can, maybe you can describe the beetle and what it does. And...
Well, it's not necessarily a beetle, but like a little waspy thing that that lays its eggs in the twig, right?
Okay.
Kind of like cicadas.
Yep.
Lays the egg there, and then the little larvae inside moves around on the inside, and then... They call it a oak twig pruner.
Ah.
So it moves around on the inside, like basically girdling the little branch, right?
That's much
little
too,
stem.
That's too much, much too nice a name for a bug that destroys the tips of the limbs.
So basically they'll, you know, snap off later. But they need it to do, again, just like the cicada, they need that to happen because then you're inside of the twig and you fall to the ground and then you can pupate the rest of the way.
Okay.
And then you hatch out in the spring. So basically the easy control, it's not really that difficult if you have an incidence of any sort of twig girdler, because the girdlers usually do it on the outside, like chew on the outside.
Right.
Picking up all the debris that falls because the insect is pupating in that debris. So get that up and out and destroyed, removed, whatever, from the scene, and you won't have that next generation.
It sounds like the little like the petiole leaf borer I deal with every spring.
Yeah.
The maple leaf borer.
Just, right.
Just, they fall off, the trees come out, they look great, and then for a week or 10 days I get leaves raining down on my pond.
Right.
And I try and clean them up.
And the pest is in the leaf, in the petiole. Yeah.
Yeah, so. You're stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, clean up your debris, and that will take care of that. And the galls are kind of interesting, too, because oak galls, are, you know, there's like leaf galls, there's twig and stem galls, but the oak gall is usually twig and stem gall. That's like an enzyme reaction because a wasp lays its egg, and then the tree forms this protective thing. It's actually part of the tree, but the interaction between the enzymes of the tree and the wasp create this protective thing around the baby.
It looks bad, but it doesn't hurt them.
It doesn't. I mean, a major, you know, gall infestation can certainly cause decline, but that in and of itself usually isn't. So it's kind of cool. We should probably do a show on like these weird,
galls,
totally not understood things.
Like, humans, like ingrown hairs in a human.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of a little irritant, huh? Nothing good comes from that, though, huh?
We have a question from an unhappy tomato grower named Debbie. My tomatoes are just starting to come in. My big boy had one fruit with what looks like blossom end rot. I also had a lobe rotting in my mortgage lifter. Oh, that's terrible. Also have green zebra, and those look great. Could it be a calcium deficiency? If not, any idea what it could be?
I say yes, it's a calcium deficiency. Basically, the blossom end rot thing is caused by a calcium deficiency. The calcium deficiency is brought on by like severe fluctuations between like too wet and too dry. If you think about the weather, that's exactly what has happened. So, you know, not that surprising. I've had some blossom end rot in my zucchini. Ooh. In fact, not the tomato so much, but the zucchini. But now that things have moderated a little bit, no more blossom end rot. So it's not unusual for that to happen, you know, when there's a very extended dry period. And then, you know, some of these pop-up storms have dumped a whole lot of rain in certain areas.
Yeah.
And that will cause that calcium deficiency. You can buy products that can restore the calcium level pretty quickly by just spraying it on the foliage, like Stop Rot. They're all labeled for blossom end rot treatment. So,
and Debbie had part two.
Oh, okay.
The leaves on her plant of her big boy have stayed curled even when well watered.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be part of the problem of blossom end rot, curly leaves?
No.
That's
a different animal. That's actually a fabulous sort of protective mechanism. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, think about it. It's so hot outside.
Yeah.
And the sun is beating down on these plants.
I know.
And the best way to conserve your energy and not transpire all your moisture is to curl your leaf. And that means that, you know, not so much leaf surface is going to be exposed to the boiling temperatures of the hottest summer on record.
It's the tomato equivalent of sitting on the back porch with a beer, I think.
Yeah, under some shade.
Yeah, that's what I mean,
you know,
porch, yeah.
So leaf curl is really just a defense mechanism under these circumstances.
Okay.
So, not surprising.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246.
Bob, it's Plant Story Day. What do you got?
You got to help me in this one, kiddo.
All right.
I'm walking around the garden. I come across these enormous and dwarf flowers, almost like dinner plates.
Mm-hmm.
They're gaudy, colorful. What are they?
Hibiscus.
You got it. That was a tough one, wasn't it? So I'm wondering, where did that name come from? It's kind of a fun name, hibiscus.
It's got to be like some Greek goddess.
Close.
Okay.
Greek god, almost.
Okay.
A living god, though. It's a very interesting story.
Uh-huh.
It's a great plant. It's in the mallow family, which is more than 200 species. Most of them are native to the warm temperature and subtropical areas of the world, you know, but the genus includes annuals, perennials, shrubs, and trees, including the hibiscus syriacus, or Rose of Sharon, which is not from Syria, actually. It's from China, and now is a national symbol of Korea. But the hibiscus has many uses over thousands of years. Paper making, used in drinks with rum and wine, for tea, food coloring, grass skirts, wigs, blood pressure medicine.
Excellent.
Candy. And if you're in Tahiti and you see a woman with a single red flower behind her ear, she's looking for a husband.
All right.
Yep. Very interesting how it got its name. It goes back to 50 AD, and a Greek physician, pharmacologist, and botanist named Pedanius Dioscorides. I'll say it again. Pedanius Dioscorides. He served in the Roman army of Nero and traveled all over the Roman and Greek world collecting all information available on animals, vegetables, minerals, and insects that were used to treat human health problems.
Like Lewis and Clark almost.
I know, we just keep thinking everything's new.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is new. He wrote a 5-volume, heavily illustrated pharmacopoeia that was quaintly titled Regarding Medical Materials. Isn't that fun? It listed 600 plants, was translated into several languages, and was widely read and used for 1,000 years.
Wow. How's that?
Talking about an impact. He wrote of the powers of opium, marijuana, and blackberries, and the various medical uses of mercury and arsenic. He got a lot of it right, but he also suggested using bedbugs to treat malaria, which could have caused some problems. Anyway, one of those plants was hibiscus, from the Greek hibiscos, which was Greek for marshmallow. And yes, that's the sticky roots from the marshmallow plant that the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts cooked over the fires for hundreds of years.
Huh.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
Comes with a poem.
Who knew?
Let me offer this name early, if you please, that old Greek doctor, Dioscorides, who wrote 5 volumes on pharmacology covering opium, arsenic, and herbal tea, that for 1,000 years was on the medical shelf and something I might have used myself to fall asleep or treat some pain back in the day before Novocaine. But what if I'd gone along with his shtick and tried to cure some illness with arsenic? You paid the doc and you took your chances back in the day of those medical advances. You paid the doc and were considered a wuss if you refused to munch on the red hibiscus. You paid the doc and you took your chance and waited the arrival of malpractice insurance.
All right. Hibiscus.
Hibiscus.
I have enjoyed hibiscus tea, I have to say.
Yeah, so, I have too.
Yeah, very good. Very good. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us again next week for another show.
Homegrown is produced by the prescription pill-popping Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.